I am Plant on the Line. This is thecommentary.ca. Jim Taylor joins me now. We're going to discuss his wonderful new memoir, Hello, Sweetheart, Gimme Rewrite, My Life in the Wonderful World of Sports. His career began in 1954 when, as a student, he began writing for Victoria's Daily Colonist. He delivered the paper and appeared in it. He became a renowned columnist in this country as well as an author. This is his 12th book, and along the way he's written biographies of Wayne Gretzky, Igor Larionov, and Rick Hansen. He was on last to discuss the collection of Jim Coleman columns he edited. Last year he co-wrote Matt Dunnigan's memoir. Published by Harbor, this book retails for $32.95. Please welcome once again to the Plant on the Line program, Jim Taylor. Good morning, Mr. Taylor.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us.
Hey.
The title of the book comes from where?
Well, there's a lot of sources. Hello, Sweetheart, Gimme Rewrite. There's an A.J. Liebling poster that says, Hello, Sweetheart, Get Me Rewrite. But where I found it, I used to listen to old radio shows when I was a little kid, you know, 8, 9, 10 years old, and the KC Crime Photographer and Big Town and shows like that, and they were always yelling into the phone, Hello, Sweetheart, Give Me Rewrite, and I always thought it would be a really good thing to be able to do that, but I never actually did.
Yeah. Is it in newspapers nowadays? Is there a rewrite desk?
I don't think so. It's been a while since I've been in them, but they were slowly being phased out when I was still active. Because it's so much easier now. You write stuff on your laptop and it's wireless. You just pull up to some place near an outlet and you file it and it's into the place. In the old days, in the lead type days, a reporter would be out, and depending on deadline, a lot of times he simply had to just phone it in and dictate it off the top of his head, and that was to the rewrite guy who would clean it up, and that's where the saying came, Hello, Sweetheart, Give Me a Rewrite.
Is this your first memoir about your life and career?
Yeah. I did a couple of column collections. I was so naive, I didn't realize that you had to ask permission on this intellectual property stuff, and I just went ahead and did it. In this, there are, I believe it's 11 columns that I wrote, and I had to go and move heaven and earth to get permission.
And looking back, is this something that you do a lot now, I suppose, or do you just enjoy doing it? Was this the right time for it?
I tell you what happened. When I first started to write, I just left the newspaper business in 2001. I knew that I couldn't go cold turkey. It had been so much of my life. And so I started fiddling around with a memoir, more idiot therapy than anything else, and started it, wrote a little bit, and then the Jim Coleman book came along, and I put this aside to do that, and then the Matt Dunnigan book came along, and I put it aside again, and about 7 or 8 months ago, I just decided, you know, you're either going to do this or you're not. So I got back at it, and Harbor graciously said, hell yes, and away we went.
You were born where?
Nipawin, Saskatchewan, 3,000 people. We used to tell people, you say, how you get there, you head north on the sled, and when the last sled dog dies, you're almost there.
And how did you make it out to Victoria?
Well, we moved to Winnipeg, first of all. My dad died and when I was 7, and my mom got a job and ran some rooming houses and things in Winnipeg, and then we got word from my Uncle George. Mother said, we're moving to Victoria, and I said, why? And she said, well, your Uncle George lives there, and he says it never snows. So that was enough for her, and away we went, and I started newspapers there as the very reluctant part-time high school stringer for the Victoria Colonist. See, I didn't want to write sports. I had no desire to write sports. I didn't really know what I was going to do. And my journalism teacher called me in one day and informed me that I was the sports stringer for the Victoria Colonist, and if I didn't go, he would kick my ass.
That was Stan Murphy, right?
Stan Murphy, yeah. So I went. And thank goodness, because I tell people this and they think I'm kidding. The truth of it is, I don't think I have any other skills. You know, I write. That's what I do. I'm a terrible do-it-yourselfer. Well, I hate it. That's part of it. And my wife won't let me anywhere near the garden, because the last time I tried it, I slayed a rose. So that's pretty much that. This is what I do. and it's been my career, my avocation, my hobby, everything.
You said you didn't want to write sports. What were you writing then?
I got interested in journalism when I was in grade 10 in Winnipeg. We had a history teacher who didn't like history very much, and he would say to us, if you finish your stuff in a hurry, I'll read to you. And the guy he read to us from was from the column collections of Eric Nickel in the Vancouver province. And I thought to myself, my Lord, it must be great to be able to do that, to make people laugh or make them think or make them cry. And I went and enrolled in a journalism class. And strangely enough, the way those things work out, later on, Eric had a second marriage. I came over from Victoria. I'd been working over there for 10 years, moved over to the Vancouver Sun. Eric's son was the same age as my son, and they wound up playing soccer on the same team. So every Saturday morning, we would lean against the fence watching the kids play soccer, and no exaggeration, I would go to school.
Really? Yeah.
Yeah.
There's a wonderful story in the book where when you got to the colonists, your mom bought you a $35 typewriter.
Yeah.
Which was a lot of money back then. And
well, see, we didn't have any money. There was just my mom and I, and we lived in an apartment right next door to St. Joseph's Hospital because she worked there in the coffee shop, and that way you saved bus fare. I mean, it was that kind of an operation. But when I got the job at the Colonist, I came home, and there was this old Underwood, beat-up, secondhand Underwood typewriter on the table. And she just looked at me and said, if you're going to do this, you'll need one of those. And I had a little bit of a ball because I knew what the sacrifice was. And I made her a silly promise. I said, I will write 12 books. Now, I don't know why I said it. I had never written anything in my life for money. And I said that I would write 12 books. I thank the Lord that I didn't say 20, because this one is 12.
It's right. It's hard not to read the book and keep your eyes dry when you read that at the end of the book there where you write that. Do you ever figure out where she got the money?
No, I think she just saved here and there. She never did explain it. She just said that, you know, you're going to need this. And as I said in the book, we would have laughed had anyone suggested we were poor. We weren't poor. Poor is an attitude. We were rich. We just didn't have any money.
That's a wonderful way to think about it, yeah. You write, obviously, on a computer now. Do you still write on a typewriter from time to time?
I have my old Underwood, and I can see it from where I'm sitting now. It's not the original one that Mom gave me, but it's the one that I got from the province when I left after they changed to computers. I still bring it down to address envelopes and sometimes just for nostalgia so I could pound away at it. You know, the change from computers, from typewriter to computer, the thing I had to stop doing was drumming my fingers on the keys because with the typewriter, of course, it didn't matter. But if you drum your fingers on a computer keyboard and you're on deadline, you look up and there are 22,000 F's, G's, and R's all over your screen.
That's right, yeah. You wrote books about and with Gretzky, Larionov, and Rick Hansen, to name just three. Well, why do you think they sought you to write with them?
Jim Young phoned me. Dirty 30 was the first one in 1974. And he phoned me and said, or the publisher phoned me, actually, Matthew and Publications. They phoned and said, we'd like to write a book with Jim Young. And I said, no, thank you. And they said, well, then we have a problem because he says he won't do it unless you do it. Now, I was the beat guy, you know, and I guess Jimmy just trusted me. And I said, well, then we don't have a problem, sir. You have a problem. But they talked me into it. I did that one. And then the Gretzky, I met Wayne Gretzky when he was in town to do Paul Anka show. And I got the idea that maybe it would be a good column idea to follow him around for a day. So I talked to his agent and got permission to do it. And that one came out. The story came out and it was pretty good. And I get a call from Wayne through his people saying he'd like me to write a book with his dad. And so I phoned Wally and we talked. It was quite funny because I phoned and introduced myself, and he said, oh, yeah. He said, Wayne was talking about that. Okay, let's do it. And I said, no, we have to meet first. And he said, why? And I said, because you might be a son of a bitch. And there's this awful silence for a second, and I said, well, I might be. But I said to you, but I said, the thing is, if we don't like each other and get along, it won't work. So I flew out, and Wally is my lifelong friend. He and Phyllis and my wife Deb and I became very close friends, and I still talk to him once a week.
So it was important that you liked them before you started working with them, right?
Oh, yes.
Did you like them after the book?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
We always hear about horror stories about people who
read books. No, there were no horror stories. The Gretzky's, you know, sometimes the persona of someone from what you read and hear is different when you meet them in person. The Gretzky's were the Gretzky's. I mean, they were just ordinary down-home folk. And, you know, Wayne was not my friend in the fact because I was as old as his dad. It took me a year or so to make him stop calling me Mr. Taylor. We have mutual respect and that, but Wally and I became really, really good friends.
Reading the book, it was fascinating to read about where you all traveled throughout your career, and you seem to have written everywhere from the press box to the newsroom to hotel rooms and so on. I have writers on all the time, and they fiction writers especially always like to say that they like to write in a specific place. For you, you had to write everywhere. Was it hard? Is it hard?
I could write in the middle of Granville Street at 5 o'clock in the afternoon if cars would not, you know, stop and let me. Most of the stuff that I do now, I do in my basement where I can write in my pajamas if I feel like it. But no, place has never been a problem for me. And also, you know, a lot of times you're in press boxes and you're on deadline, and as I related in the story in the book, I had 11 minutes to write the Mike Tyson Holyfield column where Tyson had bitten his ears, and there was a sound like a gunshot, and suddenly every second guy in the crowd seemed to have a gun, and there was a riot, and I had 11 minutes. Well, I didn't have time to sit down and say, I'm not really very comfortable here. I think I'll go to my room.
Yeah. You write that in the book that writers in your field, and writers in general, don't seem to have as much fun writing anymore.
I don't think so, and you know, maybe that's just the old fart in me coming out. I don't know, but it seems to me that we did have more fun. There's a lot more pressure on writers now because of the internet and the sort of confluence of papers and news, television stations and radio stations. everything seems to be aimed at the net now, which would make it a lot more difficult. I'm not sure I could do it, but I don't think they have as much fun. Certainly, if they are having it, the laughter is not coming through on the pages, because my big bone of contention with the newspapers is that no one seems to laugh anymore. And I made a living laughing, basically. I mean, I concentrated on seeing the absurdity of a lot of stuff in sports. You know, if a Latrell Sprewell turns down $88 million a year to play basketball and gives his reason as, I have to think of my family. You know, 88 million, 11 years. How many children does he have?
Yeah.
Or does he know?
You spent 17 years at the Province. Were you at the Sun before the Province?
Yeah, 13 years at the Sun.
You worked with Erwin Swongart.
Yes, I did.
Tell me about him. He's so fascinating to read about him.
Well, Erwin was German, and he had been a former sports editor, and he liked to insinuate his opinions on the people. He was known, you know, as Erwin, and something uncomplimentary German. I never had 10 seconds trouble with him once he found out that I wouldn't be pushed. I turned him down once. He once swore that I would never work for the, he tried to hire me away from the Vancouver Times, and I said, he offered me scale, and I said, are you out of your mind? I ought to charge you mileage, and he blew up. But later on, I got hired, and we had a good time. He was fair, he was opinionated, but he let me write, and that was the that was the really important thing for me, because I was a little bit oddball in the writing style that I had in the 70s. And in the 70s, I don't want to sound immodest, because there were better writers, but I don't think that anybody was doing it the way I did it. I mean, I was laughing, and I was using humor, and I was using alliteration, stuff from the marathon, the race at Marathon, and the Greeks, and everything I read, I was using, and some of it was really quite bad. I look at it, and I think, oh, God, you know, what was I thinking? But they let me do it, and they let me learn.
Well, what's the story about you? You had an invoice in your hand, and he grabbed it from you?
Oh, well, he had said I'd never work for the paper, and I had stormed out of his office screaming who the hell said I ever wanted to. But when he was down east looking for talent for the sports department, Bill Galt, his assistant, who I used to work with in Victoria, phoned me on a Friday and said, how fast can you get over here? And I said, Erwin would never hire me. And he said, well, he's away, and if you can get over here fast enough, I'll hire you before he gets back. So I said, it was a Friday, and I said, Monday. And I was at the Sun the following Monday. Erwin came storming in and said, what the hell are you doing here? And I said, I work here. And about, a month or so later, I was holding the invoice for my moving expenses, and he saw the head on it. You know, moving in storage or something. He said, what's that? I said, my expenses, moving expenses. And he just didn't say anything. He just grabbed it, snatched it out of my hand, and walked into his office. And about a week later, I got it back with a paid stamp on it.
We talked about Jim Coleman the last time you were on. There's a wonderful story about the two of you that I want to hear again. And I guess I asked you to tell the story last time, but I want to hear it again because it's a wonderful story. And it's about you were someplace, the two of you, and you went around shaking everyone else's hand that you knew.
Oh, yeah.
And what did he do?
Jim Coleman was one of the genuine, genuine people. And it turned out it wasn't involved me. It involved Terry Jones of the Edmonton Journal at that time. And they were covering a Grey Cup. And they decided to write at the Hamilton paper. So they went there, and Terry said that he went around and said hello to everybody he knew, and Coleman went around the room introducing himself to everybody he didn't know.
That says so much about the man, doesn't it?
Oh, absolutely. You know, I've always said that in the end, he was like my father. I mean, I loved him that much, and he was my teacher and my friend. But he was that way with everybody. That's just the way he was.
I always remember that story for some reason after I read that in the other book. In this book, you discuss your wife Deb, and it's obvious that you're still in love with her to this day.
Yeah. It's been 48 years, and we were talking about it the other day, and we agreed that the warranty is pretty much up. You know, and no, I got very, very lucky.
And you've got two kids?
Two kids, grown, adult kids now. My son Chris and my daughter Teresa, of whom I write in the book. She's in a group home. She was in a ski accident, and she's quadriplegic and brain damaged, and you know that sort of thing. But we've been one of the things, and I use it a lot in the book. I counted it up one time, and I thought, God, that's too much. But I kept saying how lucky I've been. And it's really true, because I was trying a different style. I was trying something totally different, and I had people who let me do it. The job seemed to come open when I needed to be somewhere. Everything just seemed to fall into place, and that doesn't happen a lot.
But you also worked hard. That's the sense that I got.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you talk about things you remember. Bill Good, who now, of course, is the anchor on CTV's news, he was a sports writer when I first started, and he and I went to Sapporo at the Olympics together. And his father, Bill Good Sr., was a legendary broadcaster, and Bill said to me once, he said, you know, yeah, people say I was lucky to have my dad. He said, well, he opened the door for me, but he couldn't keep it open. And yeah, I had a lot of people open doors for me, but after that, you're on your own. And I worked hard, yeah.
And are you retired now, or?
Oh, semi. You know, I just write books. I don't do anything else. People say, you know, why do you keep doing it? Well, my answer always is, well, why not? I mean, there's no heavy lifting. I enjoy doing it. The thing that always kept me going I love writing. People say sports writing is great because you get to go to the games, and that's true. But to me, the games were good, and I enjoyed every minute of it. But the best time was the time you spend after the game when you've got to write it and get it and make the words work, and the less time you had, the better I liked it.
There's a wonderful story in the book, and we'll close with this, Jim. You were in an elevator with Ella Fitzgerald. And you have an autograph of her still, right?
I have an autograph of her still, yes. But the Ali Shivalo fight was being held in Vancouver, and those people were just shamans. And they were every second word was effing this and effing that. They were in the elevator, and they were talking about what a class event this is going to be. And the elevator hit the ground floor, and I said, "Gentlemen, if you'd like to see class, would you please make room for the lady behind you? Ella Fitzgerald would like to go to work." And Ella stepped out of the back of the elevator because she was working at the cave just around the corner from the hotel. And she sort of grabbed my hand and said, "Thank you very much." And I said, "My pleasure."
You know, there's so many wonderful stories in this book, Jim, and congratulations on writing it. The humor comes through all the way through. It's a delightful book, and continued good luck with it.
Thank you very much. It's a good fun, and just for your information, the next one is in the works. I'm going to have a lifetime ambition. I am writing a book coming out next Christmas with Dal Richards.
Ah, that will be one to look forward to. But until then, we'll buy this one for sure. The book is called Hello, Sweetheart, Give Me a Rewrite, My Life in the Wonderful World of Sports, 3295 from Harbor. For the commentary, I'm Joseph Planta.